Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, May 16, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is on Roundup Weed Killer Litigation. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us Professor David Bernstein, who is the University Professor at the George Mason University Antonin Scalia Law School. After our speaker gives his remarks today, we'll move to an audience Q&A, so please keep in mind what questions you have for this case or for our speaker. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. Professor Bernstein, the floor is now yours.
Thanks. Thanks to everyone who's listening in. I should preface by saying that I was asked to do this teleforum because of my interest and expertise in the area of scientific evidence. I'm not affiliated with any of the parties. I'm not involved in litigation. I probably therefore can't answer any questions you might have later about litigation strategy or whatnot. I'm just an outsider to the case. I've been researching and writing about scientific and expert evidence since I was in law school in 1989. I served as a research assistant to Peter Huber when he wrote his book Galileo's Revenge, which helped bring the issue of junk science in the courtroom to the fore. I also co-edited with him a book called Phantom Risk, Scientific Inference in the Law. I'm co-author of the new Wigmore Expert Evidence Treatise, which you should have in your if you're lawyers out there, you should probably have in your bookshelf if you don't have it already. And in general, I've been writing about this issue for basically 30 years, and that's why I'm here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the background issues with regard to expert evidence, then get into the roundup litigation thereafter. But first, let me mention that the reason, of course, this is such a hot issue now is that there have been several trials, three trials specifically, on the issue of whether the pesticide Roundup and its active ingredient of glyphosate can cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. In each case, the jury has ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and awarded very large damages to the plaintiffs. In the most recent case, which you probably saw on the news just a few days ago, a jury in California in state court awarded tens of millions of dollars in compensatory damages and $2 billion, $1 billion to each plaintiff in punitive damages. And all these verdicts have occurred despite the fact that just about every regulatory agency in the world that's examined the safety of glyphosate says that it does not cause cancer and that it's safe for human use. So let's go back a little bit. The Roundup litigation is hardly the first litigation in which a product deemed to be safe by mainstream scientists has fallen victim to aggressive litigation. We have Bendectin, a morning sickness drug alleged to cause birth defects, which was the subject of the famous Daubert case. Spermicides causing birth defects, various vaccines causing side effects that are not really attributable to them, silicone breast implants in the 90s, and more. In all of these cases, juries ruled against the defendants despite an absence of reliable scientific evidence supporting their claims. And in some cases, like in Bendectin, at one point there were several dozen studies showing Bendectin doesn't cause birth defects, and that didn't stop the about 40% of juries in Bendectin cases from ruling in favor of the plaintiffs. So what plaintiffs typically do is rely on evidence that is directly suggestive at most only of general causation, in other words, that this product or substance may cause in general an increased risk of a particular disease. So for example, a plaintiff in a typical toxic tort case may rely on animal studies, which usually involve much higher relative exposure to the substance at issue, laboratory studies on cells, anecdotal case reports, a temporal relationship. Oh, I took the drug on Monday, and on Thursday I started feeling symptoms. Regulatory actions by the government if they were negative, analogies to similar substances known to cause disease, studies on humans involving much higher exposure levels or involving several substances together and it's hard to separate them out, which one's really causing the problem, and epidemiological studies that are too preliminary to be of much value, for example, small sample size or other issues, or are suggestive but not statistically significant, or so forth. So already we have evidence even that a substance can cause disease is often pretty speculative and not particularly valid or accepted by the scientific community. It may be the sort of evidence that says, hey, maybe we should do some more studies, but that's about it. Now then, of course, to prove causation for any individual plaintiff, what we call specific causation, you're going to require even more speculation or educated guesswork. So many experts try to give their speculation a scientific-sounding spin by claiming that they have engaged in a so-called differential diagnosis, by which they really mean differential etiology. So they say, well, look, there are 9 known causes of this disease. We've eliminated 8 of them. The only other known cause, or at least potentially known cause, is this particular substance. So that must have been it. The problem is that there's a lot of diseases for which the causes are idiopathic. In other words, we don't know what the cause is in the vast majority of cases. And that's the thing that the experts really don't take into account too. If like 80% of causes of a disease are unknown, and the other 20% we think have potentially known causes, the fact that you can eliminate 8 of them only leaves you with potentially at most 20% may be caused by the substance, if it even can cause it to begin with. So, but it sounds very scientific. It sounds like the kind of thing doctors should do, and it seems to impress juries. But really, despite the pretensions of science, these differential etiologies really amount to this. In the absence of some other known causal mechanism, I, as the expert, am willing to speculate that the product or substance at issue in this case caused the plaintiff's injury. Now, all of that sort of testimony wouldn't necessarily be a big problem if in trials on toxic tort cases, we relied on a consensus of experts, maybe experts appointed by judges or by a special master or presented by the local university or the scientific community somehow. But as we all know, that's not the way things work in the American legal system. The experts that get to testify in court, if their testimony is admitted, are experts chosen by the parties. And they're not simply chosen by the parties. They're chosen precisely because the lawyers know what the experts are going to say. If you're a plaintiff, you're not going to call an expert to testify who thinks that there is no causation. And indeed, if you are a plaintiff, or a defendant for that matter, you might call dozens of experts until you find someone who's willing to say what you want them to say. There are thousands of epidemiologists, toxicologists, oncologists, immunologists, and so on out there. So if there's anything even resembling suggestive evidence that a substance causes a disease, a good plaintiff's attorney will have no problem finding one or more experts to testify about causation. In some cases, this is because there are hired guns out there, right? There's credentialed experts who are basically willing to say almost anything for a fee. But that doesn't have to be the issue. In any given field of study, there's going to be something of a bell curve of opinion. And so it may turn out that you cluster 90, 95, 98% of the experts think there's either no evidence of causation or a lack of sufficient evidence of causation, but you have the 2% on the far end of the spectrum who, for whatever reason, have sincerely concluded that there really is causation. And the plaintiffs are well within their rights under our system to only talk to those 2%, to only call those 2%, and not to reveal how many people they've spoken to or how many experts are on the other side. So meanwhile, we have these thousands of potential experts. We bring 2 or 3 to trial on each side, maybe 4 or 5, depending on the case. And then we bring them before a jury composed of 12 lay people who usually know nothing about science and who are then charged with the task of mediating between competing scientists, all of whom are well-credentialed, who take diametrically opposite views of how suggestive the science is of causation, right? So the defense experts will undoubtedly say that there is no evidence of causation or there's not nearly sufficient evidence of causation, and plaintiff's experts will say that they are pretty sure there is causation to a reasonable medical or scientific certainty. And the jury is supposed to decide between these two sides after hearing oral testimony over a period of weeks. The most recent roundup trial lasted 17 days. That's 3.5. That's quite a while. With many other issues thrown into the litigation generally, which could include the pain and suffering of the plaintiffs, any alleged malfeasance by defendants. And meanwhile, the jurors, if they were really inclined to investigate the scientific evidence themselves and were competent to do so, can't do so on their own anyway, because unlike judges, they don't get access to the underlying written studies. They aren't even instructed by the judge as to what the legal standard is that they're supposed to apply until after they've heard all the evidence, by which time they may have already decided who's in the right and who's in the wrong, and studies show that 90% of the time they have. And then usually they only get oral instructions that are very hard to understand and deal with many different issues. So it shouldn't be really shocking that given that this is the kind of crazy way that we decide scientific issues in the court, that juries often get it wrong. Sometimes they don't understand the evidence, and sometimes they incorrectly think that they're supposed to shift the burden of proof to the defendant because that seems more just in the circumstances. Well, if the defendant didn't do as many studies as I think they should have done, you know, they should have to disprove it. They should have to prove a negative. That's not the way the burden of proof works in our system, but you could forgive lay jurors for thinking otherwise. So judges began to take notice of this problem in the late 80s, early 90s, and a series of rulings finally known as the Daubert Trilogy. As most of you probably know, the Supreme Court stated that scientific evidence, henceforth in federal court at least, is only admissible if it's reliable. The court then elaborated on that in its next opinion, the Joiner opinion, saying that even if the type of evidence that's being relied on, say epidemiology, is reliable, a trial judge can still reject expert testimony if there's not a sufficiently reliable connection between the underlying studies and the conclusions. And to me, the most key factor with regard to expert testimony in federal court, at least, with one that often is ignored. We often talk about Daubert or the Daubert Trilogy, but in 2000, the federal rules of evidence were amended to incorporate the reliability standard, but also to make it clear that judges not only can ensure that the expert is reliably extrapolating to his conclusions, but that he must do so. Expert testimony is not admissible unless, and I'm quoting from the rule here, the expert has reliably applied the principles and methods to the facts of the case. Now, in practice, this is often ignored by federal judges. I don't know how, it's very frustrating to me as an evidence professor. I teach my students what the rules of evidence are, and I see judges who will ignore it. They'll cite the rule. They'll say the rule, of course, governs us. Then they'll ignore the text of the rule. They'll cite cases from the 90s or even the 80s from before the rule was enacted, saying this is the standard in our circuit. Well, circuits can't have their own standards. They have to obey the rule, but often they don't, and that's been a problem. Anyway, similar evolutions were going on in state court. In California, for example, where two of the Roundup cases have been decided, the state Supreme Court a few years back in the Sargon case said we're not adopting federal law, but federal law is useful, and said pretty explicitly that trial judges are supposed to exclude speculative expert testimony. Okay, with all that as background, that brings us to Roundup. There is no good scientific evidence that Roundup causes cancer in general, increases the risk of cancer, or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the cancer alleged so far in the Roundup litigation in particular. Regulatory bodies around the world, which are often very cautious about what they approve, including the U.S., EPA, European regulators, Canadian regulators, German regulators, Japanese regulators, have all concluded that Roundup is safe and unlikely to be the cause of any type of cancer. Now, there are a few stray studies out there that have shown an increase in cancer in those exposed to Roundup, but there are other stray studies that have shown a decrease in cancer, which is very unlikely to be causal. And basically, if you look at the studies as a whole, all these outlier studies seem to just amount to statistical noise. The litigation for the plaintiffs has gotten a boost by the fact that one international body, the IARC, has found that Roundup is probably a human carcinogen. But even then, if you look at what they actually said, they did so based on animal studies in which animals were injected with extremely high doses of the relevant chemicals. It's really dubious to, in general, extrapolate from animal studies to humans, but even if one could directly extrapolate from these animal studies to human cancer causation, that would only mean that, okay, if you inject humans with huge amounts of glyphosate, that they will also get tumors the way the rats did or the other animals did in these animal studies. Subsequent to the IARC findings, several international regulatory bodies revisited their determination under public pressure after that decision that Roundup is safe, including the US EPA, and all the agencies that have looked at safety again have determined, have reasserted that we think that Roundup is indeed safe, and they did that in part based on flaws in the IARC methodology, but also there's some new studies that have come out since the IARC, and they said these studies are some of the best studies that have been done, the biggest studies, and that reinforces our original perspective. So in short, there really is no reliable evidence, even of general causation, that Roundup can cause cancer in general or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, much less specific causation evidence that it caused NHL in any given case. So from my perspective as an evidence professor, the judges in these cases should have excluded the plaintiff's evidence in each case and then granted the scientific evidence, that is, the expert evidence, and then granted summary judgment. They failed to do so because they did not apply the relevant rules of evidence properly. So, for example, in the federal case, the judge stated that so long as an opinion is premised on reliable scientific principles, it should not be excluded by the trial judge, and that's the rule of law of the Ninth Circuit. Well, frankly, the Ninth Circuit is such a big circuit, you can find a precedent that says almost anything with regard to scientific evidence, but this particular statement has to be wrong. Why does it have to be wrong? Because, as I noted earlier, Rule 702 explicitly says that it's not just the underlying principles that have to be reliable, in other words, epidemiology or toxicology that you're relying on, but the court must determine that the expert has reliably applied the principles and methods to the facts of the case. Now, as I noted earlier, there are plenty of federal court decisions that ignore the text of Rule 702, but, you know, if I'm advising a federal trial judge, I don't care if you could find a circuit court opinion that says this or that. You have a rule of evidence to apply. If a rule of evidence explicitly states that you have the obligation to ensure that their facts and data are being reliably applied to the issue at hand, then you have to do that. If the Ninth Circuit wants to insist the rule doesn't really say that, let them take it up with you later. Meanwhile, in California Supreme Court and California trial courts adhering to the rulings of the California Supreme Court, the rules are less clear because they don't have a rule of evidence like Rule 702. But again, in the Sargon case, the California Supreme Court specifically said that California trial judges are obligated to exclude speculative evidence. And frankly, the evidence in the Roundup litigation is quite clearly speculative, should be excluded under Sargon. Oddly enough, in at least the first of the two California trial courts, I haven't gotten to see, there hasn't been, I guess, a post-trial motion yet, that I've seen, or post-trial ruling in the case that was decided Monday. But in the first case, the court said, well, you know, this is a case involving medical science, and medical science could be deemed more of an art than a science. That's a lot of nonsense. When you're talking about scientific causation, this isn't like a doctor deciding whether to prescribe you Advil or Tylenol, and there's, you know, a little bit of an art to it, knowing a particular patient, their experience. This is a scientific inquiry. The rules of scientific evidence clearly apply, and if you're going to have a rule that says you have to exclude speculative science, you can't have lawyers come in and present an expert who literally said in this first California case, hey, I'm the expert. This guy seems to be kind of young to get non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I can't think of any other reason why he would have gotten non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It must have been from Roundup. That was the judge's explanation of why the evidence was sufficient. In fact, of course, given that most instances of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma are idiopathic, we don't know the cause. The fact that you can't identify a particular cause doesn't really tell you anything, because in the vast majority of cases, we cannot identify a cause to begin with. So you actually have to have good evidence, sound scientific evidence from epidemiology or elsewhere, that Roundup both raises the risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and raises it sufficiently to prove causation in an individual case, and the plaintiffs simply didn't have that. So that's where we stand with regard to litigation now. Obviously, now that there have been these three large verdicts against Monsanto, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more litigation. This issue is going to drag on for a while. But I have to say, in closing, that of all the other issues that I've come across in researching expert testimony in toxic tort litigation, pharmaceutical products, I can't think of another situation in which international regulatory bodies in the United States and elsewhere have been so vehement and unanimous in saying a product not just doesn't have a particularly high risk, but is actually safe, and the litigation has nevertheless managed to proceed to trials with the defendant on the losing end. So with that said, I'd be happy to take any questions you have, and again, thanks for listening.
Professor, while we wait for any questions from the audience, I do want to ask you, just looking at the lack of scientific evidence in these trials, why do you find the juries keep falling on the same side, deciding the same way?
So there's a pattern in these sorts of cases, which is that, A, you have a sympathetic plaintiff, but a sympathetic plaintiff isn't really enough because juries don't want to just be giving money away for no reason as a rule, but you also have at least a plausible case from the documents that are uncovered in discovery that the defendant in some regard was a bad actor, that the defendant was irresponsible and not doing sufficient studies, maybe they were lobbying the government to find that the product was safe. Maybe there's a document that someone somewhere in the company said, well, we really should be more worried about safety than we are. You know, one problem with this, of course, is that if you consider how many documents are produced in litigation, you have literally several million documents, but the jury doesn't see there are several million documents. They only see the 2 or 3 or 10 that the plaintiffs find especially damning. It doesn't really give you a full picture of what the company was doing. As I understand it, and again, I haven't been a participant in the litigation, the plaintiffs made a big deal of the fact that that Monsanto was involved in discussing with the EPA what's going on with its regulation, trying to encourage them to find a product was safe. Under the Norr-Pennington Doctrine, as far as I'm concerned, this should all be First Amendment protected, but it not only helped result in the plaintiffs, in the defendants losing, they wound up having, you know, massive punitive damages against them, which is kind of crazy. I mean, you have a situation for punitive damages, you would think you'd have to have willful misconduct by Monsanto, given that every regulatory agency in the world thinks that Roundup is safe, to hold that Monsanto was actually so irresponsible that billions of dollars of punitive damages should be awarded against them means that the plaintiff's lawyer really persuaded the jury that somehow, despite all these regulatory agency decisions, that Monsanto was a bad actor. And the fact is, once the jury decides that a defendant is a bad actor, they often implicitly, or sometimes they're even it suggested to them improperly, explicitly, shift the burden of proof to the defendant. And once you shift the burden of proof from the plaintiff has to prove causation to the defendant's a bad actor, we don't like them, we think they're irresponsible, let them disprove causation, that's really hard to do. That involves proving a negative, right? And having to prove a negative to a jury that's already disinclined to have a favorable opinion of you is going to be a really hard thing to do. And again, this is something that all the cases I mentioned earlier, the breast silicone breast implant litigation, Bendectin, and so forth, they all to a large extent rely on the idea that somehow the company acted improperly, even though they met all regulatory guidelines at the time, that there were some documents here or there suggesting that maybe they weren't as responsible as they should have been, and therefore we're going to rule against them but after shifting the burden of proof for them to disprove causation. So I think that is the most significant issue, especially a lot of times the jury gets lost in the scientific evidence. Sometimes they choose to ignore the scientific evidence because they dislike the defendant so much or feel sorry for the plaintiff, but sometimes the scientific evidence is so complicated that they say to themselves, well, we don't really know who's right here. Again, we have experts on each side, they're well qualified, we don't understand what's going on, so let's figure out who we think whose side is justice on. And you have some injured person dying of cancer versus a big heartless company which has some documents out of the millions that were discovered that may not make them look like the best individuals that ever lived. And so justice in that situation, it's not terribly surprising the jury may say, you know, since we don't understand the scientific evidence anyway, let's just go with that, with which party we think is more deserving, and that would be the plaintiff.
Very good. Thank you so much. Looks like we do have one question from the audience. Let's go ahead and go to that caller.
Hi, Professor. I had a question for you, and I was curious whether historically there's been examples of what I'll call the opposite situation, where the product was clearly bad and clearly harmful, but in the early cases, the plaintiffs lost. whether that's cigarettes or, I mean, asbestos or Dalcon Shield or thalidomide? Are there cases historically that were early on where the plaintiffs lost, but then as the scientific evidence built up, it became crystal clear that those products were terrible?
Yeah, I think the cigarette litigation is a clearest example of that. I mean, there are other issues there, like preemption and whatnot. But because the rules of evidence through, say, the late 1980s tend to be very lax, and basically any qualified expert could testify to anything, you would definitely have some experts on the side of Philip Morris, whatever, who would say things that really, even at the time, couldn't stand up to remote scrutiny. Like, well, you can't. In fact, back in the early 80s, when these issues first started really coming to the fore, there were some defendants, including the cigarette companies, who were really reluctant to require the plaintiffs to rely on statistical evidence, epidemiological evidence, because they were afraid, as was clear in the case of cigarettes, that statistical evidence would work against them. And in fact, statistical evidence does work against cigarette companies, and they want to say, oh, they would tell the jury, so these are just statistics, you can't rely on them, they're not individualized, we have medical testimony from actual doctors that says the opposite. So they did use the same sort of what you might call junk science techniques as plaintiffs used in other cases. Eventually, of course, the evidence on cigarettes became overwhelming, but there, again, there were other barriers. We wound up having a national settlement based on Medicaid litigation, of all things, as opposed to individual cases. But certainly there were some. But I'd say overall, I was a teenager in the late 70s, early 80s, and we had lots of scares about Three Mile Island and Love Canal and toxic torts, and that's where a lot of these cases started. And fortunately, I think we can all be glad that it turned out that for the most part, these chemical toxins and whatnot in our environment turned out to be less dangerous than a lot of people thought might be the case at the time, and that as more evidence came out, the world got to seem to be a safer place rather than less safe.
Okay, so, but in this case, you pointed out the overwhelming evidence with respect to the safety of Roundup. In a case like the silicone breast implants, where the plaintiffs won huge judgments based on some bad science or a couple of very early studies, a litigation strategy for Corning and many of those potentially would have been to just drag out the litigation as long as possible so that the better science can come in and potentially we can win these cases. And ultimately, better science did come in and any link was disestablished between silicone breast implants and harm. What would Monsanto or Bayer do in this case from a litigation strategy where the evidence, scientific evidence, is so overwhelming and the jurors, at least in these three cases, are just ignoring it and hammering them with large judgments?
That's a really good question, because you're right. In a lot of these cases, the reason they eventually petered out, Bendectin and breast implants being two really good examples, because the evidence just became so overwhelmingly one-sided that courts just started saying, forget about it. We're just going to throw out your cases from now on. So we would have hoped that the trial judges in these cases would have done that from the get-go, but they didn't. So if judges aren't persuaded, despite the existing evidence that this is true, what do you exactly do? And I suppose one potential strategy was to do what they did with regard to the silicone breast implant litigation, which is eventually put it before one judge who appoints experts, really looks into the scientific evidence. I think individual judges do tend to be reluctant to be the first and put themselves out there as excluding plaintiffs' evidence, and then maybe being the bad guy if other judges disagree with them. But when you have an MDL case where you have lots of resources, and this is sort of your job is to make that determination, that might be a different story. But I'm not counsel for any of these parties, so I have a lot less experience experience of the people who do this, so I'm not sure. But MDL litigation worked in the breast implant context, but of course only after Dow Corning had already declared bankruptcy, leaving fewer possible claims to begin with. So that's one solution. Another is just to fight really hard at the appellate level and try to get some sound opinions there. It's kind of tough because not all the judges are inclined to enforce Rule 702 or state equivalents strictly. One thing I've noticed, I hate to put a plug for my colleagues in the evidence profession, is I think there are some evidence professors out there who can sometimes help out with these things. We rarely, if ever, get called to participate in any of these cases as amici or otherwise, and I always wonder why not, because I think a lot of us tend to be fairly skeptical, and we have a lot of expertise in the area. We're not tied to the parties. We have no particular pecuniary incentive to go one way or the other. We could just as easily work for the plaintiffs, maybe more easily, but my friend like David Kay and Jennifer Mnookin, I've talked to them. They say no one ever asked them to put their two cents in. So maybe having the academic community participate one way or the other might be useful. I'm not looking for business here. I'm just pointing out that I think that the people who study scientific evidence, as a rule, tend to be as their professions, tend to be really skeptical of these cases. But they tend to be on the sidelines. They tend to write postmortems about how terrible the evidence in the Bendectin cases were, or how terrible the, like I wrote in a piece, how terrible the evidence in the breast implant litigation was, but that was years after the bad verdicts.
So one very last question. I know this is not exactly on topic, but I am curious. What is the current science and the status of the litigation against Johnson & Johnson about talcum powder having asbestos or causing cervical cancer? What's the best science, and where, from a litigation standpoint, are most of those cases headed?
To be perfectly honest, I looked into that talc litigation a few years ago with regard to some project I was working on, and I've had other things going on. I've had my, among other things, other academic projects, my daughter's bat mitzvah, among other things. I've sort of lost track of exactly where the talc litigation stands. I'm afraid I can't really give you a good answer on that.
Well, very good. Thank you so much, caller, for your questions. We do appreciate the conversation. Here's our next caller.
Hi there, Ashley Lynn. I'm a recovering lawyer, so this is going to be kind of an outsider question for those of us who don't live our lives close to tort litigation, and somewhat related, I guess, to the last question that came through. But just as an outsider, it seems to me that we hear these huge jury verdicts in a lot of these tort cases, and then they somehow get winnowed down. And I'm just trying to get an understanding of, where in the process that happens. Is that usually just at the appellate level, a judge somewhere saying, you know what, this evidence is ridiculous, and throwing it out after it gets through the first kind of pass? Or has this gone farther than, you would have expected in what typically happens in these jury cases? Thanks.
With regard to punitive damages typically get reduced when they seem to be extremely high. The Supreme Court suggested that a ratio of more than 10 to 1 of punitive to compensatory is presumptively inappropriate. I would expect the $1 billion punitive damages awards to be winnowed somewhat by the trial judge, and then perhaps by the appellate court to some extent as well, if they don't think the trial judge went far enough. The real problem is that in these cases, the compensatory damages have been really significant, and a good amount of the compensatory damages is pain and suffering. And the juries have a lot of discretion there, and judges tend to be pretty reluctant to widow them substantially. They may reduce them somewhat, but if someone's dying a horrible, painful death of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, most judges think, who am I to say whether that's worth $5 million or $15 million or $30 million in pain and suffering? It's a very subjective thing. So the damages themselves, really high compensatory damages will get winnowed somewhat. Really high punitive damages will tend to get winnowed down a lot, and it could be by a post-trial motion by the trial judge. It could be at the appellate level. As for the jury verdicts themselves, it's very difficult to get a verdict itself overturned as incorrect. Judges are judges at all levels tend to be reluctant to do that. On the other hand, in most jurisdictions, when there are evidentiary rulings, those evidentiary rulings are reviewed de novo. They're reviewed de novo. That's actually incorrect. In some jurisdictions, they're reviewed de novo. In most jurisdictions, they're not. But the judges tend to be less reluctant to overturn evidentiary rulings than to overturn ultimate rulings by the jury. So I would expect that Monsanto's lawyers are working very hard now on three appeals. I think, they probably still have some post-trial motions for the case that was resolved on Monday, but I'm sure in federal court for the previous case and the previous state court, they are working feverishly on their briefs, asking the judges both for it to overturn the verdict, but more likely to be victorious on the issue of whether the scientific evidence should have been admissible to begin with. For example, in the federal court, the federal judge acknowledged that the general causation evidence, the evidence of whether Roundup even theoretically raises the risk of cancer, was shaky but admissible. That's language from Daubert itself, shaky but admissible. But I think the relevant question I would ask, at least as an appellate lawyer then, if the evidence of even general causation is barely reliable enough to be admitted, and then there's even less evidence of specific causation that it could cause this specific cancer to this specific person, how is that sufficiently reliable on the specific causation issue to even get to the jury? So I'm sure issues like that are going to arise, but my experience with this kinds of issues is what panel you get, and very different judges have their own idiosyncratic views of how easy or not easy it should be for scientific evidence to be admissible. It often has very little to do with what the actual rules of evidence are. And if you hit the right panel, you get lucky, and you might actually get a bad verdict overturned. If you hit a panel where the judges are, like many judges, inclined to think, well, I don't really care what Rule 702 says. Our circuit has some language and past opinions that allows us to let stuff in. We're just referees. We're not supposed to get involved in these cases. If there's qualified experts willing to say so, that's good enough for me. And then they'll just uphold things. Then your only hope is the Supreme Court. And of course, the Supreme Court hasn't granted cert on a scientific evidence case in almost 20 years. So the odds of them doing so anytime soon is probably not that high.
Thanks. Sounds like we need an amicus brief from you.
Well, very good. Thank you so much, caller. We do appreciate your question. Well, seeing no immediate questions from the audience, Professor, I turn the mic back to you. Do you have any closing thoughts for us today?
I just thought at some point I might give an example of how litigation could spin out of control based on bad scientific evidence. So way back in the mid-1990s, when the silicone breast implant litigation really hadn't gone that far yet, there was an appeal to the Ninth Circuit. It was just a year after Daubert, I believe, and no one was really sure what to do with Daubert yet. And the Ninth Circuit ordered re-arguments under Daubert, and then they made a ruling. And in their ruling, they basically said, well, there's sufficient epidemiological evidence to support the jury verdict. And once they did that, the floodgates opened. Now, what was the epidemiological evidence in that particular case? There was a doctor in Florida who was a plastic surgeon, immunologist, and he had happened to have a couple of patients, I guess he was an immunologist, he had a couple of patients who had silicone breast implants and had immune system disease. So he wrote a letter to the Journal of the American Medical Association saying, hey, this is something people should look out for, maybe there's a relationship. Now, once he wrote that letter, a lot of doctors read this journal, so when they had patients who had immune system disease and breast implants, they would refer the patient to this doctor. This doctor then did a so-called epidemiological study where he looked at his patients. He looked at all his patients who had immune system disease. He figured out how many of them had silicone breast implants, and said, aha, there's a much higher rate of people with silicone breast implants and immune system disease than you'd expect in the general population. So that means that silicone breast implants cause immune system disease. Now, elementary logic, really, without any kind of scientific training, should tell you that if a doctor is getting patients who are referred to him specifically because they have immune system disease and silicone breast implants, he's going to have an unusually high number of such patients. But somehow, the Ninth Circuit decided this was a legitimate epidemiological study sufficient to support a jury verdict. So when you're dealing with this level of sort of scientific illiteracy on the part of judges, or at least a combination of scientific illiteracy and an unwillingness to do any serious policing of expert testimony, whatever the rules, official rules of expert testimony are, may not be as determinative as you would hope. So we really need to get on the judge's case, so to speak, to put aside whatever their personal views are on the right to jury trial or summary judgment or the rules of expert testimony, and ask them to enforce the rules as written, because that's really what their job is.
Fantastic. Well, Professor, thank you so much for that. We really do appreciate you being here today. On behalf of the Federal Society, I would like to thank you for the very valuable time and expertise that you've lent us. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. This call
Thanks for having
is
me.
Now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.